I mean, you're welcome, but I'm just saying. Okay, well, I'm not gonna.
Oh, yeah.
These are lights. Power bar over there.
Session 3.
I'm in that session. I don't know. It says I'm still
signing. I'm sure it's
I accept that.
everybody. And a special welcome to those of you in the street.
All right. Can we get a light on in here? Or? There. Just while my computer kind of is trying to load the presentation up here, I wanted to get a sense of who you guys are and what has brought you to the conference today. So just wondering if you can just do a quick introduction of who you are and maybe what brought you here. So we'll start.
My name is Mel, and I'm from Richmond. And what has brought me here is that I'm part of the small group ministry in our church.
Okay.
And wanted to know more about maybe bring the small group ministry to the next level.
Wonderful. Good. Tim.
Okay. I am Tim. I pastor in New Westminster, and my church doesn't really have a small group ministry. It's been very church building focused, like everything happens right there. So I'm hoping we can grow into doing discipleship in many different settings. Well, more than discipleship.
Yeah. My name is Mary. I'm a chief pastor of Jesus Rock of Ages Ministries in Burnaby. So we want to strengthen our small group why I'm here.
Wonderful.
I'm Louis Figueroa, one of the pastors also of Jesus Rock of Ages Ministries. But currently I'm pastoring right now the Sui Church. And what brought me here is that to strengthen more of our small group ministry, which I believe this kind of seminar or kind of training will help us to be more effective in the small group ministry.
You guys?
I'm Christine, and I attend Harvest City Church in Vancouver, and I've just started to lead a small group, so there's a ministry there. Mm-hmm. So coming to this conference, I think there is twofold, individually for myself to see how I may be able to strengthen the group and how to contribute back to the church ministry now.
I am Clifford with the King's Community Church. We're here in Langley. I've been up the fountain training here. I'm on staff with them. I also lead a small group as well as coordinate the other small groups. So I come to learn whatever.
Yeah, you can.
I'm Alex, also Figueroa.
Oh,
yeah. We're not related, I guess.
No,
it's nice seeing you. I'm the worship director at my church, and my idea is if I could get our worship teams to be small groups, And so we're trying to get an idea of how that could possibly happen.
All right, that's great. Guys, welcome. We're just kind of quickly sharing our name and where we're kind of connected in and what brought us to the conference as a whole. So.
My name is Ryan. I am serving at Living Waters Church here in Fort Langley, and I help to lead small groups at our church, so that's what connected me to the conference.
Great.
Same thing, but my name is Ruben.
Okay.
we work together.
Not also Ryan. And then some of you might already recognize Mick. He came because he's presenting. I don't know your history there.
My name is Mick Nelson. I'm on staff director of discipleship at Broadway Church in East Vancouver. And one of the things that's under my portfolio is facilitating the relational connections that are necessary to advance discipleship. Small groups is one of the main relational connections that we try to make. Not only one of the main ones that we're trying to grow. Most of our small groups actually meet on site. We do two that meet in homes. Has to do with the regional church, so on and so forth. So I'm always looking to learn new ways to make this work better.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. Just by way of introduction,
for me a little bit. My name is Kyle. I know it's spelled with a J, but it's pronounced without a J. And I'm on staff at Dunbar Heights Baptist Church on the west side of Vancouver by UBC. Oversee discipleship and leadership development there. Graduate of ACTS, and I just today going to talk a little bit about kind of structure, a way of structure. Talk about multi-leveled groups. It's not an exciting term. What I was trying to do is take a whole bunch of different models that both kind of have two groups that run together, and so the only name I could come up with that described them all somewhat accurately was to call them multi-leveled, but we'll look at some of the individual models. Before we get started, and before I kind of define multi-level groups and look at what we're going to talk about today, wanted to start just with us talking about what the goals of our small groups are. So you guys are each involved in small group ministries in some way, and hopefully you've taken the time to think through what are we trying to accomplish in our small groups. So just wondering if we can kind of list those out now. And if you are a live streaming, sorry, I forgot to welcome you. But if you're live streaming, you can go ahead and type into the chat bar, and we have a guy on the computer who will kind of raise your concerns for you, a voice for the voiceless, as they say. So why don't we go ahead and list some of the, what are your goals in your that you're trying to accomplish in your small group ministries? Yes, Tim.
Follow up and application of sermons.
Application of sermons, okay. Can you guys see in this, or should I? Or let's do this. I apologize for my writing and spelling. I don't know if you can even read it. It might as well not even write it, but whatever.
For us, the way we look at all small groups in our church, basically, we believe that the life of the church is fleshed out in small groups.
Okay.
So that's where the small group serves its purpose.
So what are the types of the ways of the life of the church?
Relational, you know, the fellowship.
Okay.
Personal growth. Bible study, application of sermons. Mm-hmm. I mean,
okay.
You know, so because one meeting on Sunday doesn't cut it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you it's know, in another so context to engage in engage everything in the church does.
That's what is at core.
Okay.
Practically reaching the neighborhood.
Okay. Just put it under outreach.
We use the tagline prayer, care, and community.
Prayer, care, and community. And what do you mean by community? Exactly.
Just providing a place for people to connect with believers, whether that's community with fellow believers or connecting with non-believers or non-believers.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you guys? Yeah.
How to develop small group leaders and at the same time how to increase the numbers of the members.
Okay. So how many people are being involved in small group? That's one of your goals, is to get people involved to connect deeper. Anything you don't see up there? Let's see. We have something like outreach, maybe discipleship. Like that.
There's different ways, I guess, people do it, but one of the ways I think about the task is become like Christ, to belong together in relationship, and to bless yourself and others. So become, belong, bless. I was inspired by this, so I thought I should share my.
Become like Christ, belong with others, and what was the last one?
Bless.
And bless others. So that one's not really out here. Bless. Bless. Be less. Belong. Bless. When I look at what we try and do with small groups, we often can often put them into two categories. You have You have two different categories that you have. Oops. Yes, what are the objectives of our small group members? We have some that fall under discipleship. Okay, I've used that term here, and it's more more talking about we want this. We want to build into a certain number of people. We have a defined group, and we want that group to grow. We talk about things like care. We can care for them because it's a place where they can share their troubles, where they have a certain safety and a certain level of trust that they can share what's going on. So then we can care for them, or we can pray for them because they feel safe to in this small group, in this community, to share things. We can look at personal growth. We can take a sermon. We can say, hey, I know that this sermon was talking about this, and it impacts me this way, and I look at your life, and because I love you and you're my family, I can tell you that you can grow in this way if you apply the sermon in this. You know, you need to, and we can look at each other, we can challenge each other, not judging it, not judgmentalism, but in terms of caring for each other and applying the truth of what's preached to us and the truth of God's word to each other. So that's kind of a discipleship focus. But then we also try and do another focus, an integration and outreach focus. So it might be integration. You try and gather people who maybe only connect on Sunday morning. We want them to have a place where they can belong deeper, that we want to integrate them into another level of community. Or maybe it's outreach. We want to take people who are outside of the church and we want to bring them into the church. Maybe it's kind of that belong to a community and then through that come to belief in Jesus Christ. Maybe it's something like that, belong before they believe. But it's integration, it's outreach, it's more focused on a wider community, and the idea is to bring people in. So this one is to dig down with people who are there. You want to go them to go deeper. And the other one is that you want to take a different set of people and you want to make them bigger, more people. So one is outreach, the other one is discipleship, one is depth, and the other one is breadth. And I find that often in our discipleship groups, our small groups, we're trying to aim at these two goals together. And I think that's valid. I think that is something, both of these are things that small groups can do well. Problem is they can't always do them well together. Just illustrate this a little bit, the kind of the tension between them. You talk about caring. You want to, in my small group, I want to provide a context where people can share what's really going on in their life. So I can ask them, how are you doing? And they don't just say, fine. They say, you know what? I've really been struggling with my pride this week. My wife pointed out something to me, and instead of admitting it and confessing and apologizing, I just got mad at her and thought she was nitpicking at me. And really, when I thought about it, it was about my pride. So can we as a group just pray for my pride this week? So we want that in our small groups, right? But if you're constantly inviting new people into this small knit community because you're doing outreach, because you're integrating new people, then you lose a certain amount of that feeling of vulnerability, that being able to be vulnerable, because you don't have the same level of trust for everyone around. So you will always maintain, you might have people talking about pride, you may not, depending how comfortable people are, but you're not going to get people going, you know, even deeper. You're not going to get people really sharing the depth of who they are, because there's constantly new people around and they don't have that feeling of safeness and comfort. So small groups are great at both providing depth or breadth, but not so great at doing them both together. So that's where we see these things of multi-level groups coming in. So I just want to kind of give you a sense of where we're going, what we're going to talk about. First, obviously, we're going to look at what multi-level groups are. Then we want to talk about some of the theory and purpose behind multi-level groups. This hints at it, some of the dual nature of being able to do two things well. The potential pitfalls. It's so annoying when someone comes and does a presentation about all the good things, but they don't tell you, you know, how the negatives. And there are definitely some things to watch out for. You know, if you're thinking about doing two levels of groups, some of the potential pitfalls that can fall, things that you need to be aware of. And then just from my own experience, look at two different models from my own experience that I've done this two different ways. And then when I look at that, talk about, you know, what worked well, how we dealt with some of the pitfalls that we'll talk about, and then just some other anecdotal experience from that. And then we should have lots of time for questions to either dive into the two specific models or other questions about things. So that's where we're going to go. One, just what are multi-level groups? I'm really, I'm going to point to a few examples. Probably familiar with Holy Trinity Brompton. If not, you're at least familiar with Alpha. I don't know if your churches have ran Alpha, but at least how HTB does Alpha is they want you, they encourage people after they've graduated from Alpha to be involved in a pastorate. And a pastorate is really just a mid-sized group of 30 to 50 people. And then off those pastorates, they have small groups. So here, that's the whole thing of a multi-level group is a group that has two levels. So you have a pastorate, which is a mid-sized group, and then off of it, you have a kind of a typical, a normal small group. Or another example is 3DM Ministries. You might have heard of a guy by the name of Mike Breen, who is an Anglican minister in the UK. The name of his church is escaping me at the moment, but he moved to the States, and he runs an organization called 3DM, and he talks about clusters. Clusters are a lot similar. They're missional mid-sized communities. He calls them the extended family, and then off of their clusters, they run small groups. Again, the same idea of you have a group of 40 to 60 people, and off of that, have your home group. So you see this idea of a multi-level group basically being a structure that allows for two different levels of groups that work together. They're part of a single discipleship strategy, but they're two different contexts of community to accomplish the two different objectives, the depth and the breadth. Another example is Soma Communities. Jeff Vanderstelt out of Tacoma, Washington. So they have their missional communities as their central point of belonging, their central point of community. Then off of their missional communities, they have, what do they call them now, DNA groups, which are groups of two or three, four people that really drive deep. So he's got, again, these two different levels. And then this is just my church. I had to throw our logo in for me to come. So those are just a few examples of churches. And they're all doing them different ways. So this is not a one-size-fits-all type of thing. But what is common in all these models is they're using two different groups that are part of one discipleship strategy in order to hit both a breadth and a depth. In their discipleship strategy and in their small groups. Okay, is that clear so far? Kind of the general concept of these multi-level groups. I'm fine with questions from the floor, so just go ahead and shout out. Same goes for you, live streamers. Just write any questions you have, and we'll deal with them right away. Yeah.
The question that comes to my mind is, as opposed to having this larger group, mm-hmm. and then you have the smaller group at the end, which I suppose is the concept of multi-level. Is there one way this one group mm-hmm. meets in two different settings and say, one week we are just focusing on breadth, mm-hmm. and the other week, I'll say once a month we focus on breadth. Say, let's do something where we are inviting more people, etc. But the rest of the weeks, we just focus on that.
We'll talk about that a bit with one of the models that we use that I've been a part of, where we had kind of a missional mid-sized group, and we did events that were intentionally to reach out beyond our group. The idea was to make our friends that didn't, our individual friends that didn't know Christ, to introduce them to our larger group. And they were just social events that we used to kind of introduce the rest of our group to our friends, to give them more Christian friends, was basically the idea behind them. So in a sense, it was kind of like that you're talking about. So we had these breadth-focused things. But we still had small groups that went even deeper than our regular group, because we were constantly inviting new people into our cluster, into our regular meetings, and we just wouldn't have been able to maintain the depth that we had in our small groups, even if we said, because the alternative would be, we would have to say, okay, all you people that are just kind of on the fringes of our group, you're not allowed to come, you know, next week. Next week is just for everyone else. So, you know, you got to decide if you're in or you're out. And we didn't really want to do that. So, I mean, it is possible, but then you have to think through, okay, how are we going to do it where the people on the fringes that we're reaching with our breadth aren't feeling like they're being ostracized and put aside. So that's just kind of how it works. But excellent question, and you can kind of work through some of the thoughts. My goal today is not necessarily that you adopt one of these models. My goal is that you think through, are we wanting our small groups to offer both breadth and depth? And if our goal is for both of them, how are we going to do it? Because they're often at odds, and this is just some way to think through it. So I want to talk about some research coming from Edward Hall, and if you were in Mick's session, you would be familiar with these already, and maybe I'm not even going to explain them right, but we'll go ahead. Hall is a sociologist, and he talks about sociological spaces. This is something that, if you read Mike Breen from 3DM, that he's big on too, and he talks about these different spaces of life, and the largest space is public life. So people are involved in public life. This is where you share your common experiences. This is where you connect through outside influence. It's also if you picture it in a room, it's a place where you connect with people who are 12 feet away from you. There's a certain amount of distance. It's just public. You connect based on what, you know, you're not going really deep, just on something else is bringing you together. So this would be like in the morning session when we were all in the same room. We were all there. We weren't connecting with each other. The only way we were connecting with each other was that we were listening to the speaker. So it's a hockey game where everyone is there, but they're there to watch the hockey game. This is the public space. Then you go deeper, you have social space. Social space is where we offer a true and authentic snapshot of ourselves. So we're not lying about who we are, but we're also not doing the whole picture. It's that picture that's on the back of book covers. That's what we're doing for people. You know, the picture of the author that's on the back of the book cover. You know, they're not lying about who they are, but it's not the everything of who they are. So it's a social space, and it shows people what it would be like to have an authentic relationship with us. It's not having an authentic relationship with us, but we're showing them what it would be like. This is to use again that picture of it's people who are between 4 and 12 feet away from us. So this morning it was a great picture again because we were all there listening to the speaker and we were sitting at tables, and each of the tables, if you measure them, they were probably about 4 to 12 feet from each other. So we were all in our own little groups and we were, you know, a certain distance from everyone else around us. And they saw how we interacted, but they weren't actually interacting with us. So you could look from one table to another table and see how someone was interacting with their group, but you wouldn't actually interact with them by yourself. And then if you go deeper, you have personal spaces. So this is where we start to share a private expression and our private experiences. We're talking about our thoughts and we're talking about our feelings. So again, in this morning, it would have been the people at our table. We're about 18 inches to 4 feet away from them. And we're interacting with them. This would probably be like normally the typical small group type of experience. And then finally we have a private or an intimate space. This is where we share that bare bones, naked information about who we are, and we're not ashamed to do it. So in this morning, if there was married couples, you would have seen even in sitting at their table, they would have touched, and that would have been not awkward. I because I knew that I was going to teach this, I tried to just rub my elbow, like bump the guy beside me this morning to kind of picture what a private space is like, and I could not bring myself to do it because it was awkward. I knew as soon as I hit him, it would be awkward, and it's very awkward when you touch somebody unless it's already in this private space. So you have these four levels: the public space, where you have quite a bit of distance from people. This is like groups, 100 people or more. Okay, sure, go ahead and prove me wrong that you can touch. That's great. You have the social spaces, probably a group of about 20 to 50 people. You have the personal spaces, maybe a group of 5 to 15 people, and then you have the private or intimate spaces. And really, you can only have a few people in that space. Really throughout your life, there's many people who go through and they don't really reach this level. And different people have different comfort levels in each of these groups. So you have, and they have different sizes of their circles. So you have people who can really only exist in the public space. That's the only thing they're comfortable in. And you have other people who are never comfortable in a public space unless they have people in some of their smaller spaces. So it's just a sociological reality about how we are as people, that we operate in these four spaces with different levels of comfort. Any picture that. You got any questions about how that works? Now, the way this connects with small groups is because we have this intimacy idol. Intimacy or vulnerability is kind of a buzzword of our time, and we want to be intimate. We want to, in our church, we're like, oh, we're Christians, we should be vulnerable with one another. But that's not really how God designed us. He designed us with these four spaces in mind. So yes, intimacy, vulnerability is a good thing, but it only belongs in a certain space. I remember someone telling me that they were at a church, and it was a church that met in a gym, and there was 300 people there, and the guy who started the service, he's like, I just want to have you guys welcome you into our living room here. And the guy's looking around, he's like, this is not a living room. This is 300 people. This is not a living room. I don't feel like I'm in somebody's living room. I feel like I am in a big gathering, and I feel, you know, I interact different. I'm not going to interact in this facility the same way I would interact in someone's living room. We want to have that intimacy, but it just doesn't happen in different size spaces. So intimacy isn't really the goal of all of our groups, of all of our types of relationships, because you can only be intimately connected with a few people. You can't, even maybe even in a home group of 15 people, there's not a particularly, there might be some extroverts that can connect on that level with 15 people, but I'm, despite the fact that I'm talking in front of a group of people, now I'm more of an introvert, and a lot of ministry leaders tend to be a little bit introverted, and a lot of people are, and they can't connect intimately with 15 people. So we just have to be aware that we desire intimacy to be a part of our groups, but it only happens in some of the smaller spaces. Has that been your guys' experience, that we value intimacy, but it doesn't always happen in the groups that we're a part of? Yeah? Okay. Good
question.
Yeah.
Sociological spaces, mm-hmm. Does gender, culture, and upbringing somehow play a role in
these
spaces?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And each person's approach to the spaces are different, and that's definitely affected by their gender and their culture and their upbringing and their personality, how comfortable they are in each space, how big the bubble of each space is. I know for my wife, her personal space level is much smaller than mine, so I can be comfortable in a personal space type atmosphere with a larger group than she can. Her intimate space is only two people. She can never connect on that level with a group greater than two people. And on the personal level, where you're just a little bit not quite as open, she can't connect with more than five. Whereas most people, it's probably more like 10 or 15 that they can connect on that sort of level. And that is that because of her gender or her upbringing or her personality? I'm not exactly sure, but it does have an impact on it. And everybody's kind of reaction and the size of their bubbles is a little bit different. So it's a good observation.
I think the other thing I noticed as I was exploring this concept is we move our emphasis from space to space depending on what goes on in our life experience. So, you know, I've had a disappointment in private space that has bounced me back to a social space to kind of find some safety and security while I kind of process, you know, some of the dissonance that took place in the private space. And so all of these are valid spaces for relational connection. And our trouble as a church many times is we tend to pick one or two and idolize them, as you said, usually the intimate space, the public space.
Yeah.
And we forget that people connect with us in all kinds of different ways, and it's all valid. Depends on what we're trying to do in that space.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what I'm trying to point to, is that we have these different spaces, and then we just need to be aware of what we're trying to do with our groups and then fit them accordingly. So it's about... it is about structure. Like these, in one sense, this is structure. This is skeleton type stuff. And a lot of times we look at that and it doesn't have life. But the life of it comes in understanding that our structure forms what our goals are. So we need to know what our goals are, and we can't just accomplish anything using any size of group. We need to think of what we're trying to accomplish and then structure our groups to create the best environment possible. So structure by itself doesn't do anything, But goals by itself doesn't do anything either. You need to make sure that, what your vision and what you're trying to accomplish can be even done by the structure that you've put in. And then you build the structure and then you breathe life into it by training leaders to accomplish things and by setting vision and by all these other things. So let's look at some of the strengths of multi-level groups. First one we talked about is just this ability to have an open and a closed group. So an open group is a group that you are constantly inviting to. In fact, it's probably a group that one of the main goals of the group is to invite people to it. So when I share some of my experience when we were in kind of more of a cluster model, one of our goals was we had a lot of people in our age group who were not connecting beyond a Sunday service. And so our goal was to actually become stalkers. And I know that's not a poorly charged word, but we would stalk these people who were part of our age demographic, and we'd say, we want you to be to connect deeper with us. And it was really funny because it was this group of introverts trying to connect with these people. So that was one of our goals, was to invite and people in. So that's an open group. A closed group, their goal is to build a sense of vulnerability and community. They want to achieve that intimacy. So because that's their goal, they have to close their doors. Now, it doesn't mean their doors are locked shut and no one's ever allowed to come in, and it's the same small group for 15 years. But it does mean that that you're careful when you're bringing new people in, and you understand that when you invite someone else to join you, that's going to change the dynamic of the group. You need to be prepared for that, and you need to lead accordingly. So you have an open group and you have a closed group. And multi-level groups, because you have two different levels of groups, you're able to have one that's open and one level that's open and one level that's closed. It also provides a context for equipping and ministry. So when you think about the different gifts and roles that the Spirit gives us as believers and gives the church, they're not all fulfilled in the same type of space. And so by providing different levels, you help people with different personalities, different gifts, and different roles to have a context where they can benefit the church. So this is a common verse that we talk about a lot now, as we kind of, the church in North America is moving beyond a pastor-centric approach, and we're rediscovering not only a priesthood of all believers, but understanding that everybody in the church is supposed to be equipped for the work of the ministry. And we look at Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. So Christ Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors, and the teachers, so these roles and gifts, to the church to equip people for works of service, so the body of Christ may be built up. So we have, Christ gave us apostles and evangelists and prophets and pastors and teachers in order that the body of Christ is equipped so that the body of Christ can do the work of the ministry. Well, where are they going to do the work of the ministry? Where are they going to be equipped to do that? The more surface area you provide for them, so you have different levels of groups, the more opportunity you give different personalities, different people who are equipped different ways, the better chance you have of them actually getting equipped. So it's like same concept of, you have auditory, kinetic, visual learners. You provide as much different type of learning as possible so that all those different types of learners in your class actually learn. Same thing goes when we're doing discipleship. We put people in different sizes of groups in different contexts so their personality, the way that they learn best, that they experience best, they have the opportunity to do that. Not only from the learning side, the receiving side, but also from the giving side. Because we don't only want to equip them, we're equipping them for a reason so that they can do the work of the ministry. And the work of the ministry might be among the church. So a smaller group might give someone an opportunity, again, like my wife, who is never going to talk in a Sunday service, who's never going to talk even in a group of 15 people. She has a chance to share some of her insight in a smaller group. Okay, and I think there's a lot of people like that. So they give them a chance to minister as well. So that's another strength of the multi-level group, is gives more context for people to both be equipped and opportunities for them to minister. But like I said, not everything is roses. What are some of the potential pitfalls of multi-level groups? The one is, does this look like anyone's calendar? It's a lot of people's calendar. People are busy. How can you, I can't even get people out to small group. How am I going to get them out to a, you know, mid-sized group and a small group and maybe a discipleship group? How are we going to do, as soon as you add another group, it's going to be impossible to do. In most contexts, you can only expect congregants, even dedicated congregants, to be involved in one thing, not even necessarily one size of group, but one thing outside of Sunday morning. So one service opportunity, one small group, one discipleship group, only one. You just have one chance. And people are busy, so how are you going to add different levels of groups? And we'll talk about some different ways that that can happen. Second, community and openness. So if you meet less, the reason this comes up is because the common way to deal with the busyness is to have an alternating schedule where you meet with one size of group twice a month, and on the alternating weeks you meet with the other size of group. So that's the easiest way to deal with busyness, but then it leads into this problem, that you meet less frequently with your group, so then the community doesn't build as quickly. So we'll talk about some of the ways to overcome that challenge. The other one is redundancy. We don't have a knife set exactly like this, but we do have a big block of kitchen knives, and the only thing I ever use them to do is to cut cheese. And I have no idea why we need so many kitchen knives to cut cheese. Apparently it's because they each have different purposes or something like that. But unless the leadership and the people who are involved understand the different purpose of each group and they act accordingly to the different purpose of each group, you're just going to get a whole counter full of kitchen knives with everyone just using them to cut cheese. It's going to just be redundant. So you need to really think through, if you have two different levels of groups, what are the goals of each group? How is that different from the other group? And you need to over-communicate it to your leaders. You need to have your leaders over-communicate it to the people who are part of their groups. And you actually need to follow through that. And then when you meet in your groups, actually try and accomplish those goals as opposed to the goals of the other size of group. So redundancy is a potential challenge. Continuity is another type of challenge. So while each group is distinct, a lack of continuity leads people to often only join one or the other. So, okay, I'll just join this level but not this other level because I don't see how they fit together, how they're continuous. But there needs to be a strong sense that even though there's two groups, they are part of the same discipleship strategy, two groups in one discipleship strategy. Leadership. If I polled you, probably most of your churches would have difficulty raising up enough leaders to lead the small groups you have, let alone adding a whole nother set of groups on top of that. And then content, something very similar. It's so much more work to find two different levels of content and what are we trying to accomplish. So those are some of the challenges. And when we talk about the two different models, because the answer for some of these challenges is different in some of the models. So we'll kind of look at how, in my experience, we've battled some of these challenges when we go to talk about the two different models. Okay, are we tracking here? Any other challenges that jumped up in your mind that maybe you're like, oh, I'd want to do two levels of groups, but I have this challenge? I thought really hard about all the challenges, so I'm pretty sure I got them all.
What about past experience?
People's past?
Past experience. Like, they've tried it out.
Yeah.
Didn't work, tried it out again, still didn't work.
And that's a challenge that you get with any, like even just with regular small groups. And you have to hope that A, people don't have bad experiences, and B, that you can model to them, you know, that it's working and they can be involved. But overcoming bad experiences, regardless of what you're talking about, it's very difficult to do, and it only comes really through having people connect with them who are having good experiences and saying, you know what, why don't you just give it another try? And that's what we found kind of with some of our work, is that we try and communicate very regularly when things are going well. So when I was this experience I'm going to talk about here with the cluster model. Sorry guys, I didn't realize how small that was. I guess you haven't been able to read the presentation. With the cluster model, we as a group were basically evangelists for being involved in deeper community when we went to our service. Our service had a lot of disconnected young adults, and we wanted to help them to connect into deeper community. And then we took that community and we helped to reach our neighbors. So we were constantly trying to talk with people after the service, and very naturally saying things like talking about experiences from our community. So our missional community, our cluster, moved. We had to move places, and we went to visit my family for Christmas, and we were in Alberta, and we were gone, and our group moved all of our stuff to our other place. So we talked about that a ton. We got a lot of mileage out of that conversation, and just other things that our groups were doing. And we talk about it a lot, as much as we can. And people, even if they've had bad experiences, they see, okay, this is a good experience for this person. I'm going to risk having another bad experience to come. Last week, I'm getting ahead of myself because this is now talking about the second model. We have discipleship groups that run off of our small groups in the church I'm involved in now. And last week we had a video up just interviewing people who are a part of those and how that's made a change in their life. So the more often, you know, whether informally or formally, you can get people who are having good experiences, help get their stories out, then it's a good way to encourage people to overcome some of their bad experiences in the past to come.
Mm-hmm. That we face is the whole geography issue.
Yeah.
When you are spread out like we are, people do actually identify themselves with their neighbors. They're not good with voice. Mm-hmm. You know? And so somehow I'm just sort of thinking in my head, okay, so this is one of the things we need to examine, but you know, we would almost need like Surrey cluster, Regent cluster, Coquitlam cluster, West End cluster, North End cluster, then. You know, to sort of build that up. And I just know the different mentalities in some of those different communities. It's a challenge to overcome, but it's one of the challenges of doing something.
Yeah. For you listening live stream, the challenge was just brought up of geography. And I don't know where you guys are located in the country, but in the city we often get people from different areas of the city that come together for one church, but they're quite spread out themselves. So how does that work when you might be dealing with people who are from a large geographic area? Okay, so we're going to move into the time of looking at two different models I'm not using these because they're necessarily the best, but they're the two that I have experience with, so that I'm able to talk from. So for example, I really love what Jeff Vandersell does in SOMA, and I'd love to talk from his model exactly, but I haven't been a part of it, so that would be a bad idea. So I'll deal with the ones that I am more familiar with. And this first one, like I said, comes largely from Mike Breen and 3DM. Where I experienced it was actually here in Langley when I was going to school. I was a part of Langley Evangelical Free Church, and we had a cluster model. So the idea of it is this, that you have a cluster or a missional community. Some people use the same model. We'll call it a missional community or a mid-sized community or a family community. And what we did for our context was that was between 20 or 30 people. We met in homes primarily, so 30 was pretty much our max. I remember one of our groups got to 30, and we had the people in the living room, the kitchen, the deck, and the backyard, and we were trying to have one kind of we were singing together, and it was awesome, but it was not sustainable. It didn't work. We wouldn't be able to continue that long term. So we eventually formed two groups out of that. The phrase that Mike Breen likes to use is that it's small enough to care, but it's large enough to dare. And what he means by that is that 20 to 30 people, you can know them relationally. You can't be intimate with all of them. You can't have that level with them, and that's why you need the other size of group. But you do know them. You do recognize when somebody's new. You can care for them. Large enough to dare, that's the missional component of it. That you, they had tried to be missional, to reach their neighborhoods, to do tangible acts of service for their neighbors with a traditional small group of 10 to 15 people, and or less than that, and found that they didn't have enough resources. But it was a little bit larger so that they were able to do a little bit more significant works. it's the cluster model is formed, the cluster is formed around mission, so that you can form groups out of all sorts of things, geography, life stage, but the core for a cluster model is to form it first around mission. And the way you do that is by identifying a mission field. And we learned that the best way to identify a mission field is to do it geographically. But we did also do life stages. So we had, during my time there, we launched two clusters. The second one was young families, and we just dreamt up ways that we could connect and reach young families in our neighborhood, and we did different things that did that as well. So you start by forming your cluster around a particular mission, a particular mission field. Cluster was seen as the main center of community. We really practiced life together. If you were in what's his name's, just check my Dennis's breakout session before lunch, he talked about being involved in life rhythms, which means that you're living life to community, but again, that busyness idea that no one has enough time. So you do life in community in the natural rhythms of life. You eat together, you celebrate together, you grieve together, you do those things, things that you are already going to do that everybody does. You just do them together, or you do them with people you're trying to connect with. So in that way, Cluster was more than a meeting. It wasn't just, we did meet, but we were a community. We were more than just a meeting. We met in homes or public spaces. Our gatherings always centered around a meal, because that's just better. And it included singing, teaching, sharing, being together. So we would have a little bit of teaching time, a little bit of sharing. It would be a lot of, usually we'd have one person come and kind of bring a little bit of a devotional, and then just open it up. Hey, how's, you know, does anyone have anything that they want to share? But it was largely quite social. It was a place that we invited people to, and then with that, we'd often have times that we didn't even have our tradition, our regular, time of worship or anything, and it would be, we'd be out in a park, and we'd be trying to connect with people, that we'd all kind of bring our own friends, and we'd connect together. But then off of that, we have small groups. So small groups were between 5 and 12 people, and there was more of a focus on personal care. There's community in the larger group, but more personal care in the smaller group. There was a greater depth of sharing. There was more consistency. So because our cluster was not so much about the meeting, not everyone came every meeting, especially when we were young families and things were just going crazy. But small groups, everyone made an effort to get out to small group, because there was more consistency because of the depth of sharing. There was also more focused meetings when you're in a small group. You know, when you're there for a purpose. Oftentimes we were there without our kids. And young parents know that when you're there without your kids, you want to be very strategic, because you don't want to waste that very precious time that you don't have your children. And so we have had more study during them. So that's kind of the model. I just want to talk about how we overcame some of the challenges. Actually, first of all, talk about what it did good. Our particular cluster experience was particularly good at getting fringe people who had never been a part of out of anything outside of Sunday morning to be a part of. So there was one couple in particular that we had managed to connect with. We saw them, you know, 1 month, and then we wouldn't see them. We didn't see them for a while, and they would always come in late with their Starbucks and leave early. So it was very clear to them that Sunday morning was just about them, and it was just for them to come to the service and do their thing, and then they came late, so they didn't have to connect with anybody, and they left, so they didn't have to connect with anybody. And just through a series of events, we were able to connect them in, and then they grew into leadership, and then they hosted a small group, and then they led the cluster when we left. So that was kind of a particular strength of our group that we had. We had great times of living in community, of giving different people a chance to share our gifts. Our meetings had a feeling of family worship. We had a lot of opportunity to connect in non-Christian friends. So there's a few of those who came to know Christ and joined the community because they came in, they were friends with one person, and they became friends with everybody. We had the good fortune of being a part of, we were in that during the when the Olympics were in Vancouver, and we just had this massive family gathering around the Olympics with all of our, you know, individual friends, and connected them all together, and a lot of those kind of ended up joining part of our group. We were doing mission together, and that was bonding. The parallel one, when we had when we did our young families one, because we were one family, but then we had different small groups. One of the great challenges of having young families is that they have trouble engaging in small group because they don't know what to do with their kids. So if you have a little bit older kids, you can get someone to babysit, but when you have you know, 0 to 3 year olds, it's a lot more difficult because they don't usually want to stay with anybody that isn't their parents. We spent so much time together that our kids, I used to get mad. During this time, we rented space from one of our friends that was also in our cluster, and my son would keep calling him dad, and it just frustrated me. But what it did mean was that he could always stay with them. You know, he didn't have separation anxiety from us because they were a part of our family too. So we were in different small groups, and they watched our kid when we went to our small group. And then they didn't have kids at that time, but we had other friends that would watch the other kids. So you're all part of one family, but you're meeting in different small groups on the alternate weeks. And the parallel small groups would often watch each other's kids. And that's not saying that's always going to work out, but that was just one advantage of how it worked out. And it was pretty cool to see, aside from the fact that my son called another guy dad. But what are some of the challenges that we had to overcome? So we talked about time. So we overcame that by meeting alternately between the clusters, the larger group and the small groups. And then our clusters met on the pattern of life. We shared meals. We did all those things together. So it didn't seem to take up as much time. We overcame that difficulty about community was because our small groups came from our clusters. It's very important if you have multi-level groups, the more continuity between the people you can have, the better. So if you're in your small group, you're meeting with the same people that you meet in your large group, it's easier to build that sense of community. If you're meeting with two separate types of groups, most people can't maintain that many relationships. Bunch of other ways that we overcame it, but redundancy, we overcame redundancy because clusters were very clearly places of connection and mission. Small groups were centers of study and discipleship. We did notice that with some of the other clusters, if there wasn't a strong mission focus, then those who had already connected, if it's not now a place of connection and mission, it's just a place of connection. If you're already connected, no one wanted to go back to cluster. They only did it out of duty to connect with other people. So it's important if you do that model that there is a sense of mission and connection. There wasn't really an issue with continuity because it was very clearly linked that they were part of the same thing. And with leadership, we focused on growing our cluster leadership. We poured into that leaders, and we just said that the small group leaders would take care of themselves, and they did. I don't know whether that was just dumb luck or if by the way the model that it works. The other model, and we'll have time for questions after. I just want to make sure that we do that. So we'll do the second model first, and then we can open it up to questions about the specific models if we want. The other model is what I'm doing right now, and we're hoping to modify how we do this as well, but this is just one way that we're doing multi-level groups. So we have home groups. Oops. There's 7 to 20 people. They're centers of community and care. We do sermon discussion questions, trying to take and see how people are reacting to the sermon. How are you thinking about it? What does that reveal about who you are? How do you want to apply it? They're application driven, and they're the first place we direct newcomers to. So we have a group of people that tries to meet people who visit the church, and the first thing that they do, you want to be a part of Dunbar Heights, why don't you come and check out a home group? So they're open places where people are kind of invited to be a part of. Then off of those, we have discipleship pods, which are groups of 3 to 4 people. There's obviously a discipleship focus. There's a deeper study. There's particular things that they go through. It's a place of accountability and sharing. That what we've really tried to do is the content is important, but what's more important is them being involved in that size of group and trying to get people to really share their lives with each other and to grow in that way. So what works well is that the pod size provides an accountability that is not easy to maintain in any other group size. It also allows for a personalized but very in-depth study, and it isn't divorced from application. So it's very hard in other sizes of groups to do personalized application because you have just so many persons to apply to. But if you have a small group of 3 to 4 people, the group together is helping to each person to apply. And in most of our cases, there are people who are involved in the same, you know, vocation or something like that. And then there's a lot of similarity in their application. Some of the challenges, again, you overcome. So what were our main ones? Time. Again, we overcome the challenge of time by meeting alternate weeks. A pod meets 1 week. Home group meets the next week. A lot of our pods meet in evenings, like lunch hours. Some meet in the morning before work. Some meet on weekends, times when traditional home groups generally don't meet, because a group of 3 to 4 people, it's a lot easier to get your schedule to shift, to meet together. So we have a group of finance guys that meet downtown every second week. Usually every second week, but they all travel so much that they move their schedule around, and it's easier for them because it's a smaller group to do that. So that's how we overcome some of the things with time. Community, definitely this one is more of a challenge to continue to build community in both those sides of groups as much as possible. Again, we try to have people in your pod or also people in your home group, but it doesn't always work. We don't have a problem with redundancy. We talk about a single discipleship strategy. So people who are connecting at are part of Dunbar Heights, we ask them to do 4 things: to connect with God and others on our Sunday morning services, to belong by joining a home group, to grow by joining a pod, and to scatter by living out your transformed life in the place where you work, play, and live. So we constantly talk about our discipleship strategy, and they have 2 different parts in it.
Say that again.
We invite people to connect with God and others on our Sunday morning services, to belong by joining a home group, to grow by being a part of a discipleship pod, and to scatter by living out your transformed life in the place where you live, work, and play. So that's our discipleship strategy, and it helps us to communicate the difference between our home groups, where you belong, where you have a sense of community, and our pods, where you grow, where you apply things deeper. With leadership, we haven't really had a problem with leadership either, because pods don't need leaders. They have facilitators, and you do need quality people to be facilitators, but not in this. They don't need to be trained like leaders do. They have material that a wide variety of material that they can pick. They can pick what they want to go through. There's a whole bunch of topics, and it's biblical, theological, applicational material that gets them in the scriptures, gets them in some readings, and it's designed to be a little bit more user friendly. So I have facilitators who I connect with, but that's their only job. Their only job is not to lead their groups. It's just so that I have a point person that I can call up and say, "Hey, how's your group going? Do you have any challenges? How can I help you?" And that's their only role. And we've only been running it for a year, so there's lots of time for trouble and problems to arise, but as of yet, we don't have any issues with leadership in that way. All right. That's sort of the models in a nutshell, but I wanted to give some time if you had any questions about how those models work or anything. So I feel like I blew through those 2 models.
So in the cluster model, what draws the cluster together? Is it usually, like you talked about, yours was young families, so is it usually demographic driven like that? Or is it geographic, or is there one that's working better than
the other? Yeah, so the question was, in the cluster model, what works best to draw them together? And this is what we found, is that if you want them to gel quickly, demographic particularly life stage, is the easiest, but it's also the weakest. It draws them together quickest, but it doesn't hold them together as well. So if you want to create a strong bond, then you have a strong sense of mission on what are you reaching. The easiest way to do that well is to have a neighborhood and then to kind of identify. So some of them would do a school. One group was, they kind of melded the two, so they had a particular life stage, but they connected strongly into their mission. So they were involved in sport, and they adopted a sporting field. And they said, we are going to connect with the people who play on this sporting field. And they all the families involved with that weren't in the same program, but they were all in soccer, and they all played soccer on the same field. So they would connect with other families that met there. So we took our young adults and we connected originally because we were all in the same life stage. But we asked them, we said, even though there's some people from outside our neighborhood, we said, we lived in a cul-de-sac, we were like, we want to connect with our neighbors here. So we built a deck for our neighbor. She was a young adult, but she kind of adopted us all as her children. She was a single mom with empty nest children, so we were her surrogate children, like all 30 of us. And we brought her into our community, and then just doing service for other people in our neighborhood as well, and then gave us an opportunity to invite others. One thing that's interesting about a young adult age is that serving others is a common value. So we found more often we're like, okay, we're gonna serve, you know, let's take care of this neighborhood park that we have. We rebuilt some things that were falling apart, and we're like, how's that connecting with anyone? Who are we gonna share the gospel to because of that? What we found was that some of our friends from work or from other things were like, well, that's cool, you guys take care of that neighborhood park. Can I come and do that with you? And then we'd come, and then they'd have a barbecue, and they'd kind of be a part of what we were doing. And so even though we weren't serving a people, and you know, we weren't evangelists in the strictest sense in that, people were wanted to be a part of that, even though we were motivated out of love for Christ, but they weren't. And then they became part of our community through that. So mission is the best binder for your clusters. All right. Any other questions? Anybody on live stream world? Do you have any thoughts or questions about the different sizes of groups? Yeah, Tim.
To clarify the picture of what this looks like, in your experience, would you have a cluster or a larger group 1 week and then the smaller thing the other week and have them alternating?
Yeah.
Because you talked about the awkwardness of going from the cluster to the small and not being exclusive, but was it just kind of understood that, hey, this cluster is a bi-weekly thing?
Yeah.
And then you try to help people connect into the deeper one if they wanted to?
Yeah. That's exactly right. So that's what we would do is cluster was something that met every second week. And once people were involved in that, and we could see that they were wanting more, then we would actually, both of our clusters were led by our two or three small group leaders. And we would actually, this sounds harsh, but we would actually sit down together when we met regularly or by phone, and we would talk about some of the new people that were connecting in. We're like, we would basically farm them out to a small group because we didn't want to be fighting over them. So we would say, okay, how about you connect with them? I think they'd fit better in your small group. And then you invite them. And so our wider gatherings were a place for people to come and to be a part. And as they connected in and we saw them wanting something deeper, then we'd invite them to one of the small groups. There was a time when we, in order to give a different flavor to our cluster meetings, we periodically break into small groups for our small groups for prayer. We found that did the opposite of what we wanted it to, because it did ostracize some people. So we stopped doing that, and we just met as a cluster, and then when people needed to connect in further, we would invite them. All right, sorry.
Yeah, talking about either the cluster model or the pod model, how do you grow them in, like, if you have two right now, mm-hmm. how do you grow a third or in either cluster or pod model?
I'll talk about cluster first because I know that better because as we actually did that. We had, and this is one of the challenges of doing arranging just by life stage. Because we started our first cluster on being young adults, but unfortunately we had a few of those young adults that were married, and they stayed relatively young adults, but they moved into the realm of young families. Fortunately, God overtook, and despite that organizational mistake, He allowed us to birth. That's kind of funny because we had to move because we all had kids. To birth another cluster in a very healthy way. And what happened, actually, our original cluster, by the time we left, had three children. So the first time is our group just suddenly exploded in numbers. But it was quite obviously there was a relational, not animosity, but there was a relational division. Just there was two separate groups that met as one, just how it worked. And sometimes you'll get that, particularly in very rapid growth. You might see that some of the newer people in are almost a group to themselves. So we recognize that. We say we're getting much too large for this house. And so we talked to some of sort of the informal leadership of that other group. I mean, nothing was formed, but we just said, hey, we would love it if you would have launched this new cluster. And we started inviting them to our meetings to see just how we organized, how we thought about our cluster strategically, talked through mission with them, looked at kind of where they were located and the type of people that they were more relationally connected with, and then we sent them out, and they took like our whole, like half of our group and went. And so there's that. And then when we decided that it was time for us to move on, we just took three couples. So there's quite a large group, and we took three other couples. They were having kids, and we said we have a vision to reach young families, and this is what we want to do. And so that was more just on myself and my wife, because we were thinking about how we wanted to grow from that. So the one sent out just like church planning, you know, you can send out a large group, or you can send out just one to start something else. You can split down the middle, or you can just send a leader. So there's different ways in terms of that, how you launch. But just like when you're planting a church, you pray that it's not because of division, it's not because of bad, you know, anything bad, but that you're growing and planting out of that. In terms of pods, it would be a little bit different, because cluster, you're talking about the main, that's the main group. Pods is the secondary group in the home group model. So what would actually happen is a new home group would form, and then as the home group forms, the new pods would form out of that. So actually, I'll say it another way. We do want our pods to multiply a little bit. We've had home groups for a while, but we just launched our pods. And we didn't have 100% buy-in. So not everyone who's in small group is in a pod. So what I intentionally did is all the new pods that we launched had three people, which meant they all had room for one more person to come, because the ideal size, you can flex it a little bit, but the ideal size is 3 to 4 people. So I launched them all with three. Most of them now have four. And so I talked to them about, you know, if you guys have other people that you want to bring on, then that's a great opportunity for you to have someone experience pod for a little bit, and then to go and start your own if you want to do that. And so it does work that way too. So you just think through your structures. How does it work when things grow and split? And also understand that you need to think through it, but you can't plan it all. There's a certain amount of messiness. If you are mirroring life with your community life, it's going to be a little bit messy, and strange, and sometimes you're going to be like, I hope this works and no one has hurt feelings. So that's definitely something that happens when you start new groups of any kind.
You're saying not everybody was part of that 7 to 20?
Everyone, almost. We have, right now in our church, we have about a 70% buy-in on home groups. So 70% of people who connect regularly with our church are part of a home group.
Yeah, but say a particular home group that has 7 to 20 people. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is in the pod.
Yeah, we just launched our pods, and so we have 70% of our church in home groups, and probably 55% in pods. So there's like a dozen or so people who are part of home groups but aren't a part of pods.
How do you know the pod is based on what?
How did we determine them?
Yeah,
that was. The smaller you get in terms of a group size, the more difficult it is for you to say, go and be with these people. So with a home group, you can say, if you're in this neighborhood, you know, you go there. So it was a lot of prayer and careful consideration, but perform some, you know, I was saying to someone earlier, it was like doing arranged marriages when I was forming these groups. And so what we asked is for people to, if they were interested in joining a pod, they filled out a form. And part of that form was, you know, is there somebody that you connect with that you've talked about forming a pod with, and tried to keep that. We also tried to form them as much as possible from inside of their home groups already, so it's a lot of the same people meeting. And then other than that, it was neighborhood and availability. So the more geographical closeness you can provide somebody, either in their home or their work. So we have some people who meet during work hours, well, you know, lunch breaks, they're not on company time, but they're meeting from their work environment. Then we keep them as close as possible to other people who are, you know, so they're not traveling too far. And the same if they're meeting in the evening at home, that they stay close. So I just made a big spreadsheet and checked off people who went together. And then there's a few groups that were just the leftover people, and I prayed really hard, and it worked. I'm not saying that's the best model, but I'm just telling the truth. So, yeah, there was one group of ladies when I was like, I don't know if they're going to connect. One was... had a Scottish background and grew up in a strong Presbyterian church. One was Chinese background, grew up in had an atheist background. One was Canadian, had a nominal Christian background. And I said, I don't know if they have anything common. But the lady just called me yesterday and she was like, you know, it's just amazing how much we're different, but how much in common we have, and how much, you know, what we're going through right now is similar, and just the connection that they had. And she's like, you did a really good job of forming our group. And I was like, yeah, I thought you guys would get together really well. When honestly, I did not think that the group was going to go well. So if there's any way as a leader that you can avoid forming the groups and they can form organically, that is far superior. It just wasn't possible. Do we have time, or are we out of time? When are we, 2:45? Okay. I guess that is it. Thank you, and have a good afternoon.
So there's a whole bunch of people. I mean, there's not just blue. I mean, there's just two others.